Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We were all sad to hear of the death of Kofi Annan, the 7th Secretary General of the United Nations. He joined me on stage at this year's Global Philanthropy Forum on the occasion of his 80th birthday. Sadly, he died in August. We'll hear his reflections on global leadership and the lessons he learned from his career as a diplomat. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. To what do you attribute this decline in trust?
First of all, let me thank you for inviting me, and I'm very happy to be here with all of you. Jane has been trying to get me here for some time, and finally I'm here. She doesn't give up. Well, let me start by saying that I think we have serious difficulties in our societies, not just here in the States, but around the world, because I believe the social contract between governments and the people in many cases has broken down. And people do not, particularly those who have been left behind, do not feel that the governments or the leaders are paying any attention to their concerns and their problems, and therefore tend to lose interest in the leaders, in the institutions that they have set up to support them. I think the world is changing, and changing very fast, and I'm not sure we are adapting fast enough to keep up with it, and it creates a sense of hopelessness and despair for people who have lost their jobs and don't know what's coming next. And I think when we look at the changes taking place through technology and innovation, we are almost at the point where the Industrial Revolution was, and one created a safety net to help those left behind. Or after Second World War, when lots of people were in desperate situation, and the safety nets were created. Today we are not discussing these safety nets, and I think there are needs for them. But the politicians don't seem to have taken it up and are not discussing it with the people. So if you are desperate, if you feel left behind or being left behind, and nobody is giving you a hand to pull you out of your desperation, you give up, and sometimes you get angry. So there's lots of anger and fear out there, which creates problems for politicians. And of course, I think the other problem is we are broken into silos, even on social media. And we get messages reinforcing our prejudices, reinforcing our belief in our tribal group, and therefore makes it very difficult for serious dialogue and compromise. And this is the situation we are facing today.
We're going to have a panel on the third day focusing on the role of the digital media. But my understanding is that the Kofi Annan Foundation, you also have an initiative that's focused on the digital media and its role in strengthening or undermining democracy.
Yes, I think we are very much interested in governance. And because of that interest, we do lots of work on elections. 6 years ago, 2012, I convened a group called the Global Commission on Elections, Democracy and Security, looking at how you ensure elections with integrity. Elections with integrity that will offer legitimacy to the winner and also ensure that the loser is protected. Since then, lots of issues have come up, and the sort of interference through social media, through cyber, which you are discussing here in the States, were nowhere on the radar. And so I think we are going to reconvene the group to look at some of the issues of today with social media and its impact on elections. Because if you are not careful, and voters have a sense that the electoral process could be interfered with directly or indirectly by others, and their votes may not be the determinant factor. They may even refuse to go and vote. What's the point? And so we would want to look into all of these things. There are lots of issues regarding social media that we are not going to get in. Big data, privacy, who owns the data and all. But we are looking at it from the point of view of elections. And it's so serious that, for example, in Germany, they don't use computers or elections. They want to do it everything by hand. The last elections in Netherlands last March, not March last year, it was all by hand. They didn't want to take any risks. The question is, if a country as rich and as powerful as the US cannot deal with, is having problems with the social media and interference with elections, you can imagine what it means to countries like mine, Ghana or Malaysia or elsewhere. How do they deal with this? You know, so we hope that the group we put together will come with some suggestions and recommendations that will be helpful to all.
So you should probably tap the wisdom of Eileen Donahoe, who's got a program at Stanford working on some of these issues. Yeah, so, and I know good. You know her well.
Yeah.
So as you think about elections, I mean, there's sort of two points here. One is that you've also personally used your skills as a mediator to deal with post-election violence when the election is contested. So I wanted to just ask you very quickly to say a word about that. And is this something you're still doing as an ongoing part of your work?
Yes, I think now we're looking at it at both ends. After the 2012 report, all the groups that monitor elections around the world, NDI, Carter Center, the European Union, the UN, and UN came to us at the foundation, said there are very useful recommendations in this report which should not be wasted. We should follow through. But we did not want to create another organization. So what we did is to create a platform where we meet twice a year to look down the line at elections which are coming up in the next 24 months and try to identify the ones that are likely to be problematic and to see what we can do to help. For example, with that approach, the last Nigerian elections, we went into Nigeria and organized an event with civil society and all the political parties involved. We came up with a code of conduct that they all had to sign on television in front of their people, committing to fair and free elections, that nobody was going to incite violence, and that they would accept the results. President Buhari, who was the opposition candidate, signed. Jonathan, who was then the president, signed, and they respected the agreement, and they had a peace committee that was monitoring it, and we were in touch with them all the time. So that's anticipating it. And of course, you recall in the Kenyan elections, I went in to try and help resolve the conflict at a time when 1,300 people had been killed and 650,000 had been uprooted as a result of the conflict around the elections. And elections which normally should be a peaceful and democratic process of rotation of leadership leads to conflict, which is really unfortunate. In the end, in Kenya, we suggested that they form a unity government, which they did, and ended the conflict. So we try to work at both ends, prevent it, as we did in Nigeria, and where necessary, at the Kenya end, help resolve the conflict, but would much rather help prevent it than go and solve it.
And that was 2007, am I right? And working with you was Graca Machel, the widow of Nelson Mandela, who you also work with in the context of the elders.
Yeah, in fact, we had a group of three. I led the team, and the other members were Graca Machel, the wife of Nelson Mandela, and Ben Mkapa, the former president of Tanzania. They gave us a very impressive and imposing title, Eminent Persons.
So as you think about elections and that opportunity to intervene to make sure that they are, that really is a peaceful transfer of power, we're seeing more and more democracies that are democracies only in the sense that they have elections, but they're illiberal otherwise, and as a result, often unstable. What are the trends you see there, and what role for the international community, for philanthropy and civil society to play to kind of to ensure that there is a space for civil society in these countries?
For a while, civil society blossomed all around the world. But today, with a turn towards autocracy, there is a tendency to squeeze civil society. The space for civil society is really shrinking. Governments feel that civil societies are often against them. Civil society, by their nature, criticize, they hold their governments responsible, they keep their feet to the fire, and they don't like that. And there's a tendency for them to ask, who are these civil society groups? Whom are they working for? Who is paying for them? What's their agenda? Are they failed politicians? Do they want to replace us? So they come up with all these questions and find ways of complicating lives for them, often using the issue of money, that they cannot accept donations from external sources meaning from outside the country. But often these groups can't raise money locally either, so you squeeze them that way and get them out of business. But I think we should support these organizations, because global civil society has played a very important role in on many issues, on health, the fight against HIV/AIDS, landmines, international justice, and we need them. And I think we should really support them. And invariably, it's the governments that are turning autocratic who have no time for civil society.
You mentioned the possibility of people saying, well, why bother if they see elections as rigged or compromised in some way? In your work now at the Kofi Annan Foundation, you've been reaching out to young people, in essence, so that they do have agency, so that they aren't saying, why bother? The name of it, I think, is Extremely Together Initiative. If you'd say a word about that initiative, but also the guidelines on terrorism recruitment.
We work a lot with young people, and I believe in the young. They are the leaders of tomorrow. They are the leaders of the 21st century. And really, I encourage them to take responsibility and to lead. I believe deeply that one is never too young to lead. And if I may add, never too old to learn. I'm still learning. You know, and these young people have a lot to offer. The program you refer to, which we call Extremely Together, is we selected 10 young people, men and women, out of a group of 500, and each of them has an organization in their local community making contribution, already having indicated a sense of leadership in their own community. And they had also had experience with their terrorism or extremism. And they come from Somalia, Libya, Norway, and I think the young man from Norway, for example, is alive today, because when Breivik went to the island of Utøya and killed 67 people, he played dead. He woke up with dead people around him. So they come with that sort of direct experience. And they have come up with their own guidelines for young people as to how you deal with extremism. And I think peer-to-peer advice and pressure perhaps is much more effective. I have a feeling they will listen to these young people than an old man like me on the issue of terrorism. And they've doing a very good job. So we started with 10, and we're expanding the program into other countries. So hopefully the ripple effect will be such that lots of young people will be exposed, and they will set up their own organization sharing this experience. The young people have been very enthusiastic, and they've done a great job, and they are going around not only talking to young people, but are often invited to explain their approach and what they are doing to other groups.
Terrorist organizations don't recruit, they fill a gap.
Which is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And working with young people is absolutely essential, because they are often the agent as well as a victim.
Yes.
So
yes.
To getting them involved and getting them to understand what it entails.
Yeah. So I think of you as having led the United Nations as a revolutionary. So I know most people say us as a great diplomat, but you did something revolutionary, and that is that you asked an organization that was composed of sovereign states to put the individual rather than the state at the center.
Yeah.
And so say something about that. I mean, it's both true in the Millennium Development Goals, but also in responsibility to protect. How did you make that case, and how did you persuade?
I think when I became Secretary General, I noticed the organization was so focused on the political aspects and peacekeeping aspects and conflicts. But there's usually also economic basis for conflict. And I felt that if we can find ways and means of helping the poor and lifting them up from their situation, it will be helpful for everybody. And so we decided to work on this Millennium Development Goals. In fact, I did a report called We the Peoples. And out of that report came the 8 recommendations for the Millennium Development Goals on health, education of girls, and all that. And it was interesting. Not many people gave it a chance, but we worked hard with the member states, and they agreed. And then I managed to get the World Bank and IMF also to join in. So for the first time, we had a common framework for development, which everybody had accepted. The other interesting thing is, you know, the UN language can be heavy. We call it UNese. So I told them we needed a report written in simple, straightforward language and recommendations, the goals in simple language that the average person in the street in Lagos or Nairobi or Delhi can understand. And once they understood it and understood how helpful it could be for them and their families, they would also help put pressure on their governments to implement it and to deliver. And through the Millennium Development Goals, millions were lifted out of poverty in India, China, Brazil, and around the world. And that was really very enlightening. And on responsibility to protect, just before I came in, we had lived through 2 major crises: Rwanda genocide and Srebrenica in Bosnia, in Yugoslavia, where I myself spent 6 months during the war. And we keep saying, never again, you know, we had that refrain. But that was a phrase. I felt we should do something more concrete and more important. And until then, if something happened in the country and you wanted to get involved, say, wait a moment, this is our national issue, our sovereignty, you cannot come in. and the countries outside, the one in crisis often also said, no, we cannot move because of sovereignty. With the responsibility to protect, the country in crisis cannot assert sovereignty. Those outside who can go in and help cannot use sovereignty as a block. They have the right to go in. I know today we are asked, there are lots of crises around the world. You haven't intervened in this or that. My answer to that is the fact that we cannot intervene everywhere does not mean that we cannot intervene where we can. But the norm is important. And I think over time, we will see the effectiveness of that norm. It's a bit like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We have not lived up to every chapter of the declaration, but at least we have standards. We have standards where we can claim you are not respecting the rights of this individual. You are abusing their rights. And I sometimes wonder, if we had had the Universal Declaration before World War II, the power it would have given those and the encouragement it would have given those who wanted to resist, to stand up and have something to refer to, which we do today. And I think tomorrow the responsibility to protect hopefully will play the same role.
So you're referring to the Holocaust. You've recently done a study on the situation for the Rohingya, who are fleeing Myanmar into Bangladesh. Is that an example of ethnic cleansing? And what is the responsibility of the rest of us?
Yeah, that is a rather sad and painful situation. The mandate Aung San Suu Kyi gave me, actually let me step back a bit. She approached me and said, I'm going to set up a commission and I would want you to chair it. Originally, she wanted to set up a commission of Myanmar citizens, six of them, with me chairing it. And I told her that wouldn't work, you know, and that we needed to give it a bit more international character. And we agreed then that there would be three internationals and six Myanmar. So we had a commission of nine, which I shared. And our mandate was to come up with recommendations that will help improve the situation in Rakhine State, the situation of the Rohingyas, and really help the state of Rakhine settle down. Rakhine is a poorest state in the country, and so they had their own problems. And on top of that, we had the Rohingya problem. We submitted our report to the government on the 23rd of August last year, and released it publicly on the 24th. And the next day, the attack on the government forces took place. And of course, they responded, and we know the results, with about 700 Rohingyas pushed out to Bangladesh. We have more Rohingyas outside Myanmar than in Myanmar. The question is, how do you get them back? And I don't think they will go back unless they are given a sense of security. And here, the international community will have to put a sustained pressure on the government of Myanmar, particularly the military, to prepare the ground, assure safety of these people to go back. But the international community should also have a presence. I think all the NGOs who are today not allowed should be allowed to go back, all the humanitarian agencies and the press to go back to Rakhine State where the Rohingyas are. And I think that they will become eyes and ears of the international community, and there'll be pressure on the military to behave itself. And I think in the meantime, the international community has to provide the resources to help look after the Rohingya in Bangladesh. And I worry now that the monsoons are coming next month. They have rather precarious accommodation, if one can call it that. And with the monsoons, I don't know how they're going to manage. And of course, that often leads to diseases and other things. And so we have a tough situation coming upon us.
Now, as you know, there are some international organizations that are working on the problem. I think Médecins Sans Frontières, for example, is an organization that's been in Myanmar. One of the dilemmas, it seems to me, that they may face is that many of the Rohingya are in essence, in internment camps. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, within Myanmar. And so the question is, how do you help those people without seeming to legitimize that arrangement?
Yeah. In fact, in our report, we requested the government to dismantle all these camps. The camps were set up after 2012 conflict, upheaval of this nature, on a much smaller scale. And they set up these camps. When we got there, there were 120,000 230,000 people in the camps with no access to normal life, cultural, social, or whatever. And those camps were supposed to be temporary when they were set up in 2012. So we asked them to dismantle all these camps and send them back to their villages. The government accepted the report. The international community has generally also endorsed the report. The question was implementation, but with the exodus, quite a lot of them are now in Bangladesh, but we need to, as I said, get them back. But it was really unfair to keep them in camps for that long, you know, in their own country.
So I just one more question about responsibility to protect. The norm has been established because of your leadership. The mechanisms don't exist. So in the case of Libya, we could turn to NATO. Mm-hmm. There was a mechanism. And I believe that NATO, that the European countries went to the Security Council. Is that right or no?
Not really. I mean, they didn't get the council's approval.
Yeah.
I think people refer to Libya, the Libyan operation, as an example of responsibility to protect. I don't accept that. I think if indeed they had gone to Libya to protect the people, they saw these military equipment moving towards Benghazi. If the intention was limited to the protection of the people, what I thought should have happened was you could have stopped those military trucks, you can bomb them, and let Gaddafi and the people know we mean business. You stop using your military against your own people. If you insist on doing that, we are ready to take you on. But to go all the way and turn it into a regime change, and kill the leader is really, I think the best example of responsibility to protect is what happened in Kenya after the 2007-2008 elections, where without ever raising the word military, everybody cooperated, the UN, the European Union, African Union. I got my mandate from the African Union, but everybody was involved. In fact, President George Bush was in Tanzania discussing with the government. I called him and I said, I'm in Kenya, I'm negotiating. Would you ask Conde to join me? So we talked to the people and Conde came. The Secretary General was in Addis Ababa. I asked him to come to talk to the people in situations where sometimes ministers wanted to come in at the wrong time. I would tell them, this is not the time to come. The people will exploit your presence. And we all work together. The US, for example, withdrew visas of people who were causing problems. The names of the individuals were never released. So people went around wondering who was going to be next. Who is misbehaving that they may be next on the list, you know? So all sorts of diplomatic, political, and economic pressure was used to get people to behave themselves and we resolve the conflict. And that, for me, was a classic example of responsibility to protect, not what happened in Libya.
Another thing that you did both at the United Nations and in the, do now in the Kofi Annan Foundation, I mean, back to sort of mechanisms, is it you've been very clear about sort of states not being alone in advancing the public good, that there is a role for civil society, a role for the private sector. Say something about the logic behind, well, first, public-private partnerships like the Global Fund, and more recently, you helped found something called the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa. Something about those public-private partnerships, but also your specific efforts to reach out to business and to reach out to the charitable sector, civil societies.
No, I believe that we all need to work together, and we cannot leave the solution of these some of these problems to governments alone. And also, I find that governments and leaders sometimes have a short-term view. You know, they are more concerned about the next election and hardly about the next generation. Because that's a long-term goal. And I think if civil society and the private sector are involved, they also live in the communities, they know the problems of the community and the people. We can tackle the issues together. And as you mentioned, a good example was a global fund to fight HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis, where we brought together civil society, governments, and the private sector, and the board has representation from these three groups, and the chairmanship rotates. A civil society leader has chaired, so has a private sector person and a government, and it has worked very well. I mean, when I set up the fund, I think the first goal I set was let's try and raise $5 billion. Today we are over $22, $30 billion has been raised to fight HIV, AIDS, and malaria. And not only that, the private sector, the pharmaceutical companies, reduce the price of medication considerably so that many more people can get treatment. And this group, the private sector, came from a position where they were suing Mandela in South African court because he had wanted to use a general licensing to create or to manufacture a generic version of the medication for his people because it was really devastating the South African population. They took him to court, and so when I met with them, I said, look, I'm not a public relations man, but if you go and sue Mandela in a South African court on an issue like HIV/AIDS, if you lose, you lose. If you win, you lose and lose and lose. And you better pull it out of court and settle quietly, and that's what they did. But they also made a contribution, and I think that is the way to go. We all need to pool our efforts and resources to tackle the problems of the day. And I think when civil society and the private sector team up, we also give the politicians a bit more energy and a bit more encouragement, not only in terms of resources and ideas, but they realize their support for what they want to do.
So I just have two last questions. And the first is, this conference is called No Bystanders, and it's a characteristic shared by everyone in the room and well beyond. At what point in your life was that concept of no bystanders instilled in you? That sense that you had that ability and that responsibility to make a difference. And what's your advice to young people who are struggling with that question?
Yeah, from personally, that attitude came to me early. I went to boarding school at a young age, and usually when you get there, there's lots of bullying going on. So the first year I was bullied a lot. The second year I tried a bit of bullying. And then I gave up. From the third year, started protecting the younger ones who came in, which obviously also got me into trouble with the headmaster and the teachers, because they thought I was always questioning those in authority, and that it was going to get me into trouble. I remember the headmaster once calling me into his office, saying, "It has come to my attention that you are always questioning those in authority, and I'm the one who runs the school, and you're going to pay for it one of these days." And then went on to say, "I've been watching you. I think given the chance, you may turn out to be a fairly good citizen, but you have to." So I've had this tendency to always be with the underdog and the smaller one, and my own family also encouraged my father and others. And now, of course, my wife, who is here with us, often will say, "This is awful. Can't we do something about it?" And even when I go to marches, she would ask me, "Which side are you supporting?" And instinctively, I'm always with the underdog. I want them to do better. I want them to win. But I also felt that if you are not a bystander, if you intervene, you have the courage to intervene, you help a lot of people. And I tell young people, it doesn't have to be taking on big issues. You know, you may be walking down the alley in your college or on the street and see somebody being bullied or mistreated. Don't just walk by and be a by. You should be able to stop and say, "This won't work, stop it, no more." And by doing that, you're giving the victim incredible inspiration and energy to fight back. You know, and it really helps, because it is when we are all sort of passive bystanders and allow things to go on that the wicked carry on their wicked. As Ben said, all that is required for evil men to do their is for good men to say nothing. And you have, I should be careful, good men and good women to say nothing. That was his time. But I think the young people have to be courageous. They have to be able to take on challenges or situations that they think ought to be corrected and to do something about. And as I repeat, and I repeat again, you are never, never too young to lead. When the moments for leadership comes, you know it, and you can feel what you can do. We issued, I chair the elders. The elders issued this. This is also a group set up by Mandela, made up of former heads of states, like President Carter, President Cardoso, and others, which I chair. We issued a statement when the young students took to the streets after the Miami shooting. I was so proud of these young people, basically telling us old people, if you're not doing what you should do, we are going to show you. And I firmly believe that when leaders fail to lead, the people can lead and make them follow. And these young people gave us a wonderful example, and I hope they will sustain the effort and continue.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Please join us online at worldaffairs.org. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.